Now, you're very welcome back to Tip Today, 1800-938-007. The text and WhatsApp, 083-311-3311. It's time for Global Politics now with politics and economics student Thomas Conway. Good morning to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Fran.
And good to talk to you. The first of our piece today, you're taking from a thesis written and christened Peak China. Will you explain that to us?
So Peak China is this notion that the Chinese economy, the Chinese economic miracle, and the age of Chinese supremacy is already upon us. So we have a lot of people predicting the rise of China. And look, it's had a remarkable, an economic explosion, effectively. It first began to open up its economy in 1978. Since then, its GDP has grown by a dizzying rate of 9% a year. That is, comparatively speaking, quite high. 800 million people approximately have escaped from poverty. Today, China accounts for almost a fifth of global output, and the sheer size of its market and manufacturing base has practically reshaped the global economy. But there is a theory, and it's a very interesting one, that the age of Chinese supremacy is now upon us, that China is going to stop growing, well, maybe not stop growing, but slow down. Its economic trajectory is going to dip more or less.
Right.
And that we're already at this phase of peak China.
And we'll touch on it more later. But you see this as possibly being dangerous, Thomas?
Well, think about it. When you're backed into a corner, the main thing you do is kick out and fight back. And that is the danger when we think of China. China now is this great military power. It's embroiled in a geopolitical power struggle with the United States. It's, you know, in many ways, the defining feature of politics and international relations at the moment, the rivalry between China on the one hand and America and the Western order. So if China is backed into a corner, if its economic trajectory is dipping, it will want to be as influential on the global stage as it possibly can. And I see this as dangerous. I think it is a real danger. There are a number of trends underlying China's current situation. Demographics are hugely significant. China's working age population has been declining for about a decade now. So working age population between around 18 and 64 years of age in decline. Last year, its population as a whole peaked. And India has now overtaken it. India is now the most populous country in the world.
Didn't they try to do something about that, though? Didn't they try to get bigger families or encourage?
Well, they've encouraged that. Remember, China had a one-child policy until 2016 that they maintained sternly and very committed to that one-child policy. They then subsequently realised that, no, this was not working, that it actually had led to disastrous consequences. The Chinese population is dipping. They don't have enough young people. They don't have enough productive workers in their economy, in their labour force. So they have tried their utmost to encourage the population, to encourage families to have more children, bigger families. It hasn't worked. As things stand, China is really struggling. It's struggling to increase its population. And that, in turn, is dampening its economic potential.
Technological warfare as well, and that's unfolding, isn't it?
It is, and that is a particularly significant one. There are we think of China, when we think of China and technology, we think of Chinese firms like TikTok, which the US have tried to ban. And I suppose the thing about Chinese companies is they are invariably linked to the Chinese state. So it differs. If you have an American technological company, there'll be an individual, an autonomous company, you know, they won't have links to the American government. It is different in China because China has a kind of a, I won't say a centrally planned economy. It isn't a communist economy in the sense that we understand communism, but many of the firms are linked to the state. And that has generated, I suppose, concerns in the international sphere that there is a link there between company and state.
Sure, the big one, of course, then is militarily, I suppose, where Taiwan is concerned. So
And this is the real question. China's military spending is forecast to rise by 7% this year. Its navy expected to be 50% bigger than America's by the year 2030. Its nuclear arsenal looks set to quadruple by 2035. So All these statistics illustrating that China's military heft, China's military prowess is increasing. And that spells danger for the United States and the West, but it spells danger in particular for the likes of Taiwan.
Yes.
Now,
and is that immediate warfare with America if they march on, if they move on Taiwan?
Well, put it this way, America has promised to intervene. America has promised to defend Taiwan in the event of an invasion. Would Xi Jinping be audacious enough to launch an invasion of Taiwan in the near future? Who knows? My suspicion is that currently at present, they're not in a position to do so. But maybe come a few years' time, when the pressure ratchets it up a little more, Mr. Xi looking for support at home for a kind of a rally round the flag effect, it is a real and potential possibility. So it's going to be a real concern for the likes of America and the West more broadly.
And Mr. Xi, almost 70 now, but he's there for life.
He's there for life. I mean, yeah. He has consolidated his power. He looks set to be ruler for life. His grip on the Communist Party is iron tight, and he isn't loosening it any bit. So he looks to be there for life, and his vision of China, his vision of China's great rejuvenation will, I think, colour China's economic and political trajectory in the years to come.
Interesting. Let's move to Syria then, Thomas, and the return of Bashar al-Assad there. Will you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sickening in a way when you consider this man, Bashar al-Assad, for people who aren't familiar, and most people will be, Syria's president. He is a war criminal. Over 300,000 civilians killed in the Syrian conflict since 2011. That amounts to 1.4% of Syria's pre-war population. Some 6 million citizens displaced inside of Syria. A similar number have fled from the country. Assad now sits on top of a mafia economy. Before the war, get this, before the war, 50 Syrian pounds were worth $1. Now the rate is 8,700. So.
Wow.
That is just illustrative of the damage that has been wreaked to the Syrian economy. But this week, it appears that President Assad has been welcomed back in from the cold. He was at the Arab League summit, which took place a couple of days ago. President Vladimir Zelensky was there. Interesting to note that he shook hands with Vladimir Zelensky, even though Syria is an ally of Russia and has supported it in its war against Ukraine. So It's an astonishing story. It's an astonishing story when you think of the amount of international pressure and international sanctions that were put on top of the Syrian regime, put on top of Mr. Assad, that he managed to survive, that he managed to come out the far side of it. And he is still at the helm of a country which is in deep turmoil.
What about sanctions there and, you know, the implication of that where Syria is concerned?
Yeah, well, the thing about this is, and it's really interesting, in the past, I think the West has relied on sanctions and thought really that, you know, we can use this form of economic warfare to bring down foreign leaders, to reduce their power, reduce their influence. It hasn't worked.
Yeah.
I won't say it's had the opposite effect, but it really has not been as influential as people have thought. We look at Syria now. Syria was a test case. America and Europe kind of became reluctant to use military force abroad. So they resorted to sanctions, to economic coercion, imposed some sanctions on some 10,000 individuals, companies in 50 different countries. It has placed embargoes on states like Cuba and Myanmar. But in a growing number of these countries, the countries themselves are actually circumventing the sanctions. So we've spoken this about Russia in the past, how Russia has managed to circumvent international sanctions. Countries find ways around it. They find ways that they can evade these sanctions and reduce the power of them. And I suppose that is what Syria has done to a certain extent. That has allowed Mr. Assad to survive.
Millions of Syrians, of course, left the country, and presumably they'll want to return home at some point.
That is the presumption. But the way the country is at the moment, that is not a prospect. That is not a foreseeable prospect for them. Syria, as I say, is in a deep state of turmoil. I mentioned the economic statistics there. 300,000 civilians killed, 6 million displaced. It is in a real deep state of turmoil. And it's unclear how to resolve this situation. There is a question now facing the international community. Do they send in more international aid? Do they begin to tentatively engaged with Bashar al-Assad despite all his years of tyranny? Or do they leave it be for the time being?
And as you say yourself, a regime that's funded by drug peddling.
And I didn't realise this. This is really, it's astonishing, really. The Syrian regime is a leading producer of captamine, which is an amphetamine, or captagon, which is an amphetamine. And it basically sits, Bashar al-Assad is sitting on top of a mafia economy, basically. Its exports of this amphetamine have tripled in the past couple of years. The drug is highly potent. It's a dangerous drug. But Syria is now relying on it. It's relying on it, and it has this illicit trade in this drug, which is damaging to the rest of the world, but is keeping the Syrian economy afloat.
It's going to be very interesting. And just in the short term, what's going to happen here, do you think? I mean, we'll you know.
It's a very interesting one, because we saw with Bashar al-Assad being welcomed back to that Arab League summit, that some of the countries in the Middle East are now beginning to re-engage with Syria. So the question now, as I say, faces the broader international community, faces the West. Will they begin to re-engage? Will they begin to re-interact with Syria? My suspicion is that they will have to. The Syrian economy needs it needs somebody to engage with it. Syria is a country there are still civilians living in it. Bashar al-Assad looks like he is here to stay. As tyrannic and as despotic as he is, he looks like he is here to stay. So people are going to have to engage with him.
Interesting. Now, we ask you to look at a political figure for us every week. And this week, it's the Iron Lady herself.
It's the Iron Lady herself, And what, you know, fascinating character. Mm. Absolutely fascinating.
Lover or hater, fascinating.
Lover or hater, and plenty hated her, I can tell you that. And from my reading, I would have known a fair bit about Margaret Thatcher anyway. But from my reading and research, I, you know, uncovered dimensions to her that I didn't really know, that I hadn't previously been aware of. So she was born on the 13th of October 1925. She was effectively a British stateswoman, a conservative politician who served as Prime Minister of the UK from 1979 to 1990 and leader of the Conservative Party from 75 to 1990. The first ever British Prime Minister, the longest serving British Prime Minister of the 20th century, and perhaps one of the most influential figures globally of the 20th century. Her rise through the political system was astonishing in many respects. Mm. The fact that she was a woman, the fact that she trailblazed her way to power, but also the fact that she didn't really seek to elevate women's rights.
Or other women.
Yeah, and yeah. I found this to be an intriguing aspect of Margaret Thatcher as a character. She seemed to just want to get on with it. She won the 1979 general election and that ushered her into power. But she wasn't all that keen to elevate the fact that she was a woman, to elevate other women into key positions.
Interesting, is there? Her whole political philosophy, Thatcherism.
I suppose. The defining element of Margaret Thatcher, her economic philosophy, had links to Reaganism in the United States. Main focus on bringing down inflation. Inflation had ravaged the UK economy and the world economy more broadly in a similar fashion to the way it's doing at the moment. This was back at the end of the 70s, the start of the 80s. Margaret Thatcher wanted to tackle that. She wanted to fix and resolve that issue permanently. And her economic and political philosophy was kind of shaped around that. But by God, she made plenty of enemies while doing so.
Didn't she? Indeed. And particularly, I suppose, with the mine workers and the unions there. You're much too young to remember, but I mean, it was just Scargill. You heard of him and, you know, just all-out war all the time.
I looked back at a couple of the videos and obviously have read a bit about it and the acrimony, the bitterness between the unions and between Thatcher and her government was something to behold.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first few years in office then, I mean, were difficult, as you say, with the recession. It took a war, really, to rejuvenate
it took her. The Falklands War, and we spoke previously about the rally round the flag effect. It was that war with Argentina, in the Falklands Islands, that really kind of caused her her popularity, I won't say to soar, but her popularity to increase. She kind of showed herself as a strong woman leader, a leader who was able to lead Britain out of crisis.
Yes.
Now, there was another war ongoing at the time, and that was the Troubles in the North. And she certainly could be thought of to have poured fuel on that fire.
Indeed. So you mean with the hunger strikers?
With the hunger strikers. With Bobby Sands.
Yeah.
Certainly, she wasn't a sympathetic voice there. And there will be plenty of people who will criticise her for her policy position on Northern Ireland.
And of course, there was the attempted assassination on her.
Which she survived. Members of her government, was killed in one of the bombings. She survived an assassination attempt by the provost in the 1984 Brighton Hotel bombing. So she was very much part of the conflict in Northern Ireland. She didn't do her utmost to resolve it. That is clear from the reading of it.
She resigned in 1990. I still remember the images of her coming out of number 10 and into the car, and she was wiping away the tear, which was very unusual for her to show emotion like that.
We've heard about the last days of Thatcherism. You know, there's all these kind of stories and anecdotes about it. She really was... It ended badly for her, I think, really, given how strong she had been.
Which she still continued as a backbencher, did she?
She still continued as a backbencher, which is interesting. And I'll note that, you know, more recent UK prime ministers have done the same. Theresa May is still there. Boris Johnson is still floating around the House of Commons. But not everybody does that. But I think the fact that she did continue was demonstrative of just how much she was devoted to public service.
Yes.
And just how much she wanted to serve the people of Britain and the people of her constituency.
It's a whole other discussion, but her relationship with Queen Elizabeth was kind of interesting and worth a whole book, I'd say.
And it's a dynamic which is explored well, actually, in The Crown, in the series, which is... And obviously Queen Elizabeth, you know, who died last year, had a relationship with many British prime ministers, but her relationship with Churchill and Thatcher in particular was certainly very intriguing.
The one with Churchill, though, seemed to be the great fondness.
Indeed. It was slightly different with Thatcher.
What should we look out for?
I suppose there's a lot happening in the past couple of days. We had the G7 summit in Hiroshima in Ukraine, in Japan. Western leaders, the G summit, of course, is a group of mainly wealthy countries.
Yes, because Biden wasn't there; he pulled out, didn't he?
Biden did promise. He did promise to send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. President Zelensky made a flying visit. Went from the Arab League summit, which he was there in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, on to Hiroshima. The G7 has agreed to starve the Russian war machine. That is its tactic. That is what it is seeking to do. Whether it would be successful or not, who knows? You would hope so. But certainly they are ratcheting up the pressure, the economic pressure on Russia.
Sweden and their NATO bid?
Yeah, Sweden is trying to kind of project its own strength ahead of its NATO bid. Its bid was being held up by Turkey for a period of time there. That issue has been resolved, and Sweden is now investing heavily in its military. I thought it was worth noting, because given that it is about to become a new member of NATO, and that probably is fairly imminent, it will have to have a strong military.
Yes.
So investing heavily there.
And just finally, Hungary, what's that story about?
Yeah, this is another interesting one. Hungary, of course, has been in conflict. It almost seems like perpetual conflict with the European Union. It's now in kind of a spat over EU recovery funds, pandemic recovery funds. That is an ongoing feud between the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and diplomats in Brussels. So looks like I just wanted to highlight the story because it highlights the kind of the tension, the internal tensions that still exist within the EU.
All right, okay. Thomas, is always great to see you. And thanks
Pleasure,
very
Fran,
much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas Conway there. News and information is coming up.
Tip today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. You can't beat experience. With over 50 years maintaining Peugeot cars and vans, we like to call ourselves the experts. Call Slattery's Garage for a free vehicle health check today. 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.